much help his feelings, and I think God knows that, I said. Then he started to cry, and he said something that broke my heart. I tried to love him, is what he told me. I always tried, but he wouldn't let me. I swept him into my arms and hugged him as hard as I could. I think that was about as close as I come to crying in the whole business. But of course you have to remember that I hadn't been sleeping too well and still hadn't the slightest idea of how things was going to play out. There was to be an inquest on Tuesday, and Lucien Mercier, who ran the only mortuary on Little Tall back then, told me I'd finally be allowed to bury Joe in the Oaks on Wednesday. But on Monday, the day before the inquest, Garrett called me on the telephone and asked if I could come down to his office for a few minutes. It was the call I'd been expecting and dreading, but there wasn't nothing to do but go. So I asked Alicia if she'd keep an eye on the kids, and then I went. Garrett wasn't alone. Dr. John McAuliffe was with him. I'd more or less expected that, too, but my heart still sank a little in my breast. McAuliffe was the county medical examiner back then. He died 3 years later when a snowplow hit his little Volkswagen Beetle. It was Henry Brierton took over the job when McAuliffe died. If Brierton had been the county man in 63, I'd have felt a good deal easier in my mind about our little talk that day. Brierton's smarter than poor old Garrett Thibodeau was, but only by a horsehair or so. John McAuliffe, though, he had a mind like the lamp that shines out a Batiscan light. He was a genuine bottled-in bond Scotsman who turned up in these parts right after World War II ended, hootmon, burr and all. I guess he must have been an American citizen, since he was both doctoring and holding a county position, but he sure didn't sound much like folks from around here. Not that it mattered to me. I knew I'd have to face him down, no matter if he was an American or a Scotsman or a heathen Chinee. He had snowy white hair, even though he couldn't have been more than 45, and blue eyes so bright and sharp, they looked like drill bits. When he looked at you, you felt like he was staring right into your head and putting the thoughts he saw there into alphabetical order. As soon as I seen him sitting beside Garrett's desk and heard the door to the rest of the town office building click closed behind me, I knew that what happened the next day over on the mainland didn't matter at Tinker's Dam. The real inquest was going to happen right there, in that tiny town constable's office, with a Weber oil calendar hanging on one wall and a picture of Garrett's mother hanging on another. "I'm sorry to bother you in your time of grief, Dolores," Garrett said. He was rubbing his hands together, kind of nervous, and he reminded me of Mr. Pease over at the bank. Garrett must have had a few more calluses on his hands, though, because the sound they made going back and forth was like fine sandpaper rubbing along a dry board. "But Dr. McAuliffe here has a few questions he'd like to ask you." I seen by the puzzled way Garrett looked at the doc that he didn't know what those questions might be, though, and that scared me even more. I didn't like the idea of that canny Scotsman thinking matters were serious enough for him to keep his own counsels and not give poor old Garrett Thibodeau any chance at all to frig up the works. "My deepest sympathies, Mrs. St. George," McAuliffe says in that thick Scots accent of his. He was a little man, but compact and well put together for all that. He had a neat little mustache, as white as the hair on his head. He was wearing a three-piece wool suit, and he didn't look no more like home folks than he sounded like them. Those blue eyes went drilling away at my forehead, and I seen he didn't have a bit of sympathy for me, no matter what he was saying. Probably not for nobody else either, including himself. "I'm very, very sorry for your grief and misfortune." "Sure, and if I believe that, you'll tell me one more," I thought. "The last time you was really sorry, Doc, was the last time you needed to use the paid toilet, and the string on your pet dime broke." But I made up my mind right then that I wasn't going to show him how scared I was. Maybe he had me, and maybe he didn't. You got to remember that for all I knew, he was going to tell me that when they laid Joe on the table there in the basement of County Hospital and opened his hands, a little piece of white nylon fell out of one. A scrid of a lady's slip. That could be, all right. But I still wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of squirming under his eyes. And he was used to having people squirm when he looked at him. He'd come to take it as his due, and he liked it. "Thank you very much," I said. "Will you sit down, madam?" he asks, like it was his office instead of poor old confused Garrett's. I sat down, and he asked me if I'd kindly give him permission to smoke. I told him the lamp was lit as far as I was concerned. He chuckled like I'd made a funny, but his eyes didn't chuckle. He took a big old black pipe out of his coat pocket, a briar, and stoked it up. His eyes never left me while he was doing it either. Even after he had it clamped between his teeth and the smoke was rising out of the bowl, he never took his eyes off me. They gave me the willies, peering at me through the smoke like they did, and made me think of Batiscan life again. They say that one shines out almost 2 miles, even on a night when the fog's thick enough to carve with your hands. I started to squirm under that look of his in spite of all my good intentions, and then I thought of Vera Donovan saying, "Nonsense. Husbands die every day, Dolores." It occurred to me that McAuliffe could stare at Vera until his eyes fell out and never get her to so much as cross her legs the other way. Thinking of that eased me a little, and I grew quiet again. Just folded my hands on top of my handbag and waited him out. At last, when he seen I wasn't going to fall out of my chair onto the floor and confess to murdering my husband, through a rain of tears is how he would have liked it, I imagine, he took the pipe out of his mouth and said, "You told the constable 'twas your husband who put those bruises on your neck, Mrs. St. George." "Eh, I says, "that you and he had sat down on the porch to watch the eclipse, and there commenced an argument." "Eh, and what, may I ask, was the argument about?" "Money on top," I says, "booze underneath." "But you yourself bought him the liquor he got drunk on that day, Mrs. St. George. Isn't that right?" "Eh," I says. I could feel myself wanting to say something more to explain myself, but I didn't, even though I could. That's what McAuliffe wanted, you see, for me to go on rushing ahead, to explain myself right into a jail cell someplace. At last he gave up waiting. He twiddled his fingers like he was annoyed, then fixed those lighthouse eyes of his on me again. "After the choking incident, you left your husband. You went up to Russian Meadow on the way to East Head to watch the eclipse by yourself." "Eh?" He leaned forward all of a sudden, his little hands on his little knees, and says, "Mrs. St. George, do you know what direction the wind was from that day?" It was like the day in November of 62 when I almost found the old well by falling into it. I seemed to hear the same cracking noise, and I thought, "You be careful, Dolores Claiborne. You be oh so careful. There's wells everywhere today, and this man knows where every goddamn one of 'em is." "No," I says, "I don't. And when I don't know where the wind's quartering from, that usually means the day's calm." "Actually, wasn't much more than a breeze," Garrett started to say, but McAuliffe raised his hand and cut him off like a knife blade. "It was out of the west," he said. "A west wind, a west breeze, if you so prefer. 7 to 9 miles an hour with gusts up to 15. It seems strange to me, Mrs. St. George, that the wind didn't bring your husband's cries to you as you stood in Russian Meadow, not half a mile away." I didn't say anything for at least 3 seconds. I'd made up my mind that I'd count to 3 inside my head before I answered any of his questions. Doing that might keep me from moving too quick and paying for it by falling into one of the pits he'd dug for me. But McAuliffe must have thought he had me confused from the word go, because he leaned forward in his chair, and I'll declare and vow that for 1 or 2 seconds there, his eyes went from blue hot to white hot. "It don't surprise me," I says. "For one thing, 7 miles an hour ain't much more than a puff of air on a muggy day. For another, there were about 1,000 boats out on the reach, all tooting to each other. And how do you know he called out at all? You sure as hell didn't hear him." He sat back, looking a little disappointed. "It's a reasonable deduction to make," he says. "We know the fall itself didn't kill him, and the forensic evidence strongly suggests that he had at least one extended period of consciousness. Mrs. St. George, if you fell into a disused well and found yourself with a broken shin, a broken ankle, 4 broken ribs, and a sprained wrist, wouldn't you call for aid and succor?" I gave it 3 seconds with a My Pretty Pony between each one, and then said, "It wasn't me who fell down the well, Dr. McAuliffe. It was Joe, and he'd been drinking." "Yes," Dr. McAuliffe comes back. "You bought him a bottle of Scotch whiskey, even though everyone I've spoken to says you hated it when he drank. Even though he became unpleasant and argumentative when he drank, you bought him a bottle of Scotch. And he had not just been drinking, he was drunk. He was very drunk. His mouth was also filled with blood, and his shirt was matted with blood, all the way down to his belt buckle. When you combine the fact of this blood with a knowledge of the broken ribs and the concomitant lung injuries he had sustained, do you know what that suggests?" 1, My Pretty Pony. 2, My Pretty Pony. 3, My Pretty Pony. "Nope," I says. "Several of the fractured ribs had punctured his lungs. Such injuries always result in bleeding, but rarely bleeding this extensive. Bleeding of this sort was probably caused, I deduce, by the deceased crying repeatedly for rescue." That was how he said it, Andy. Rescue. It wasn't a question, but I counted 3 all the same before saying, "You think he was down there calling for help?" "That's what it all comes to, ain't it?" "No, madam," he says. "I do not just think so. I have a moral certainty." This time I didn't take no weight. "Dr. McAuliffe," I says, "do you think I pushed my husband down into that well?" That shook him up a little. Those lighthouse eyes of his not only blinked for a few seconds there, they dulled right over. He fiddled and diddled with his pipe some more, then stuck it back in his mouth and drew on it, all the time trying to decide how he should handle that. Before he could, Garrett spoke up. His face had gone as red as a radish. "Dolores," he says, "I'm sure no one thinks, that is to say, that no one has even considered the idea that..." "Aye," McAuliffe breaks in. I'd put his train of thought off on a siding for a few seconds, but I saw he'd got it back onto the main line without no real trouble. "I've considered it. You'll understand, Mrs. St. George, that part of my job..." "Oh, never mind no more, Mrs. St. George," I says. "If you're going to accuse me of first pushing my husband down the well and then standing over him while he screamed for help, you go right on ahead and call me Dolores." I wasn't exactly trying to plink in that time, Andy, but I'll be damned if I didn't do it anyway. Second time in as many minutes. I doubt he'd been used that hard since medical school.
"Nobody is accusing you of anything, Mrs. St. George," he says, all stiff-like. And what I seen in his eyes was, "Not yet, anyway."
"Well, that's good," I says, "because the idea of me pushing Joe down the well is just silly, you know. He outweighed me by at least 50 pounds, probably a fairish bit more. He ladded up considerable the last few years. Also, he weren't afraid to use his fists if somebody crossed him or got in his way. I'm telling you that as his wife of 16 years, and you will probably find plenty of people on the island who tell you the same thing." Of course, Joe hadn't hit me in a long while, but I'd never tried to correct the general impression on the island that he made a pretty steady business of it. And right then, with McAuliffe's blue eyes trying to bore in through my forehead, I was damn glad of it.
"Nobody is saying you pushed him into the well," the Scotsman said.
He was backing up fast now. I could see by his face that he knew he was, but didn't have no idea how it had happened. His face said that I was the one who was supposed to be backing up.
"But he must have been crying out, you know. He must have done it for some time. Hours, perhaps. And quite loudly, too."
One, my pretty pony. Two, my pretty pony. Three. "Maybe I'm getting you now," I says. "Maybe you think he fell into the well by accident, and I heard him yelling and just turned a deaf ear. Is that what you've been getting at?" I seen by his face that that was exactly what he'd been getting at. I also seen he was mad things weren't going the way he'd expected them to go, the way they'd always gone before when he had these little interviews. A tiny ball of bright red color had showed up in each of his cheeks. I was glad to see him, because I wanted him mad. A man like McAuliffe is easier to handle when he's mad, because men like him are used to keeping their composure while other people lose theirs.
"Mrs. St. George, it will be very difficult to accomplish anything of value here if you keep responding to my questions with questions of your own."
"Why, you didn't ask a question, Dr. McAuliffe," I says, popping my eyes wide and innocent. "You told me Joe must have been yelling, crying out was what you actually said. So I just asked if..."
"All right, all right," he says,
and put his pipe down in Garrett's brass ashtray, hard enough to make it clang. Now his eyes were blazing, and he'd grown a red stripe across his forehead to go along with the balls of color in his cheeks.
"Did you hear him calling for help, Mrs. St. George?"
"One, my pretty pony. Two, my pretty pony." "John, I hardly think there's any call to badger the woman," Garrett broke in, sounding more uncomfortable than ever. And damn if it didn't break that little bandbox Scotsman's concentration again. I almost laughed right out loud. It would have been bad for me if I had. I don't doubt it. But it was a near thing all the same. McAuliffe whipped around and says to Garrett,
"You agreed to let me handle this."
Poor old Garrett jerked back in his chair as fast he almost tipped it over. And I'm sure he gave himself a whiplash.
"Okay, okay, no need to get hot under the collar," he mumbles.
McAuliffe turned back to me, ready to repeat the question, but I didn't bother letting him. By then I'd had time to count to 10 pretty near. "No," I says, "I didn't hear nothing but people out on the reach, tooting their boat horns and yelling their fool heads off once they could see the eclipse had started to happen." He waited for me to say some more. His old trick of being quiet and letting people rush ahead into the pucker brush. And the silence spun out between us. I just kept my hands folded on top of my handbag and let her spin. He looked at me, and I looked back at him.
"You're going to talk to me, woman," his eyes said. "You're going to tell me everything I want to hear, twice, if that's the way I want it."
And my own eyes were saying back, "No, I ain't, chummy. You can sit there drilling on me with those diamond bit baby blues of yours until hell's a skating rink, and you won't get another word out of me unless you open your mouth and ask for it." We went on that way for damn near a full minute, dueling with our eyes, you might say. And toward the end of it, I could feel myself weakening, wanting to say something to him, even if it was only, "Didn't your ma ever teach you it ain't polite to stare?" Then Garrett spoke up, or rather his stomach did. It let out a long groan sound. McAuliffe looked at him, disgusted as hell, and Garrett got out his pocket knife and started to clean under his fingernails. McAuliffe pulled a notebook from the inside pocket of his wool coat. Wool? In July? Looked at something in it, then put it back.
"He tried to climb out,"
he says at last, as casual as a man might say, "I've got a lunch appointment." It felt like somebody had jabbed a meat fork into my lower back, where Joe hit me with a stove link that time, but I tried not to show it. "Oh, eh?" I says. "Yes," McAuliffe says. "The shaft of the well is lined with large stones," only he said stains, Andy, like they do. "And we found bloody handprints on several of them. It appears that he gained his feet, then slowly began to make his way up, hand over hand. It must have been a Herculean effort, made despite a pain more excruciating than I can imagine." "I'm sorry to hear he suffered," I said. My voice was as calm as ever, at least I think it was. But I could feel the sweat starting to break in my armpits, and I remember being scared it would spring out on my brow or in the little hollows of my temples where he could see it. "Poor old Joe." "Yes, indeed," McAuliffe says, his lighthouse eyes boring and flashing away. "Poor old Joe. I think he might have actually gotten out on his own. He probably would have died soon after, even if he had. But yes, I think he might have gotten out. Something prevented him from doing so, however." "What was it?" I asked. "He suffered a fractured skull," McAuliffe said. His eyes were as bright as ever, but his voice had become as soft as a purring cat. "We found a large rock between his legs. It was covered with your husband's blood, Mrs. St. George. And in that blood, we found a small number of porcelain fragments. Do you know what I deduce from them?" 1, 2, 3. "Sounds like that rock must have busted his false teeth as well as his head," I says. "Too bad. Joe was partial to him. And I don't know how Lucian Mercier is going to make him look just right for the viewing without him." McAuliffe's lips drew back when I said that, and I got a good look at his teeth. No dentures there. I suppose he meant it to look like a smile, but it didn't, not a bit. "Yes," he says, showing me both rows of his neat little teeth all the way to the gum line. "Yes, that's my conclusion as well. Those porcelain shards are from his lower plate. Now, Mrs. St. George, do you have any idea of how that rock might have come to strike your husband just as he was on the verge of escaping the well?" 1, 2, 3. "Nope," I says. "Do you?" "Yes," he says. "I rather suspect someone pulled it out of the earth and smashed it cruelly and with malice aforethought onto his upturned, pleading face." Wasn't nobody said anything after that. I wanted to, God knows. I wanted to jump in as quick as ever I could and say, "It wasn't me. Maybe somebody did it, but it wasn't me." I couldn't, though, because I was back in the blackberry tangles, and this time there was friggin' wells every place. Instead of talking, I just sat there looking at him. But I could feel the sweat trying to break out on me again, and I could feel my clasped hands wanting to lock down on each other. The fingernails would turn white if they did that, and he'd notice. McAuliffe was a man built to notice such things. It'd be another chink to shine his version of the Batiscan light into. I tried to think of Vera and how she would have looked at him, as if he was only a little dab of dog shit on one of her shoes. But with his eyes boring into me like they was just then, it didn't seem to do any good. Before, it had been like she was almost there in the room with me. But it wasn't like that anymore. Now there was no one there but me, and that neat little Scots doctor, who probably fancied himself just like the amateur detectives in the magazine stories, and whose testimony had already sent over a dozen people up and down the coast to jail, I found out later. And I could feel myself getting closer and closer to opening my mouth and blurting something out. And the hell of it was, Andy, I didn't have the slightest idea what it'd be when it finally came. I could hear the clock on Garrett's desk ticking. It had a big hollow sound. And I was gonna say something when the one person I'd forgot, Garrett Thibodeau, spoke up instead. He spoke in a worried, fast voice, and I realized he couldn't stand no more of that silence either. He must have thought it was going to go on until somebody had to scream just to relieve the tension. "Now, John," he says, "I thought we agreed that if Joe pulled on that stone just right, it could have come out on its own, and..."
"Mon, will you not shut up?"
McAuliffe yelled at him in a high, frustrated sort of voice, and I relaxed. It was all over. I knew it. And I believe that little Scotsman knew it, too. It was like the two of us had been in a black room together, and him tickling my face with what might have been a razor blade. And then clumsy old Constable Thibodeau stubbed his toe, fell against the window, and the shade went up with a bang and a rattle, letting in the daylight. And I seen it was only a feather he'd been touching me with after all. Garrett muttered something about how there was no call for McAuliffe to talk to him that way, but the doc didn't pay him no mind. He turned back to me and said, "Well, Mrs. St. George," in a hard way, like he had me in a corner. But by then we both knew better. All he could do was hope I'd make a mistake. But I had three kids to think about, and having kids makes you careful. "I've told you what I know," I says. "He got drunk while we were waiting for the eclipse. I made him a sandwich, thinking it might sober him up a little, but it didn't. He got yelling, then he choked me and battered me around a little, so I went up to Russian Meadow. When I come back, he was gone. I thought he'd gone off with one of his friends. But he was down the well all the time. I suppose he was trying to take a shortcut out to the road. He might even have been looking for me, wanting to apologize. That's something I won't never know, and maybe it's just as well." I give him a good hard look. "You might try a little of that medicine yourself, Dr. McAuliffe."
"Never mind your advice, madam," McAuliffe says, and those spots of color in his cheeks were burning brighter and hotter than ever. "Are you glad he's dead? Tell me that."
"What in holy tarnel hell has that got to do with what happened to him?" I asked. "Jesus Christ, what's wrong with you?"
He didn't answer, just picked up his pipe in a hand that was shaking the tiniest little bit, and went to work lighting it again. He never asked another question. The last question that was asked of me that day was asked by Garrett Thibodeau. McAuliffe didn't ask it, because it didn't matter, at least not to him. It meant something to Garrett, though, and it meant even more to me, because nothing was going to end when I walked out of the town office building that day. In some ways, me walking out was going to be just the beginning. That last question and the way I answered it mattered plenty, because it's usually the things that wouldn't mean squat in a courtroom that get whispered about the most over back fences while women hang out their wash, or out on the lobster boats while men are sitting with their backs against the pilot house and eating their lunches. Those things may not send you to prison, but they can hang you in the eyes of the town. "Why in God's name did you buy him a bottle of liquor in the first place?" Garrett kind of bleated. "What got into you, Dolores?"
"I thought he'd leave me alone if he had something to drink," I said. "I thought we could sit together in peace and watch the eclipse, and he'd leave me alone." I didn't cry, not really, but I felt one tear go rolling down my cheek. I sometimes think that's the reason I was able to go on living on Little Tall for the next 30 years, that one single tear. If not for that, they might have driven me out with their whispering and carping and pointing at me from behind their hands. Yeah, in the end they might have. I'm tough, but I don't know if anyone's tough enough to stand up to 30 years of gossip and little anonymous notes saying things like, "You got away with murder." I did get a few of those, and I got a pretty good idea of who sent them, too. although that ain't neither here nor there at this late date. But they stopped by the time school let back in that fall. And so I guess you could say that I owe all the rest of my life, including this part here, to that single tear. And to Garrett putting the word out that in the end I hadn't been too stony-hearted to cry for Joe. There wasn't nothing calculated about it either. And don't you go thinking there was. I was thinking about how sorry I was that Joe'd suffered, the way the little bandbox Scotsman said he had. In spite of everything he'd done and how I'd come to hate him since I'd first found out what he was trying to do to Selina, I'd never intended for him to suffer. I thought the fall'd kill him. Andy, I swear on the name of God, I thought the fall'd kill him outright. Poor old Garrett Thibodeau went as red's a stop sign. He fumbled a wad of Kleenex out of the box of them on his desk and kind of groped it out at me without looking. I imagine he thought that first tear meant I was going to go a gusher and apologized for putting me through such a stressful interrogation. I bet those were just about the biggest words he knew. McAuliffe let out a humph sound at that. Said something about how he'd be at the inquest to hear my statement taken, and then he left. Stalked out, actually, and slammed the door behind him hard enough to rattle the glass. Garrett gave him time to clear out, and then walked me to the door, holding my arm but still not looking at me. It was actually sort of comical, and muttering all the time. I ain't sure what he was muttering about. But I suppose that whatever it was really Garrett's way of saying he was sorry. That man had a tender heart and couldn't stand to see someone unhappy. I'll say that for him. And I'll say something else for Little Tall. Where else could a man like that not only be constable for almost 20 years, but get a dinner in his honor complete with a standing ovation at the end of it when he finally retired? I'll tell you what I think. A place where a tender-hearted man can succeed as an officer of the law ain't such a bad place to spend your life. Not at all. Even so, I was never gladder to hear a door close behind me than I was when Garrett's clicked shut that day. So that was the bugger, and the inquest the next day wasn't nothing compared to it. McAuliffe asked me many of the same questions, and they were hard questions, but they didn't have no power over me anymore, and we both knew it. My one tear was all very well, but McAuliffe's questions, and the fact that everyone could see he was pissed like a bear at me, went a long way toward starting the talk which has run on the island ever since. Oh, well, there would have been some talk no matter what. Ain't that right? The verdict was death by misadventure. McAuliffe didn't like it. And at the end, he read his findings in a dead, level voice without ever looking up once. But what he said was official enough. Joe fell down the well while drunk, had probably called for help for quite a while without getting an answer, then tried to climb out on his own hook. He got most of the way to the top, then put his weight on the wrong stone. It pulled free, bashed him in the head hard enough to fracture his skull, not to mention his dentures, and knocked him back down to the bottom again, where he died. Maybe the biggest thing, and I never realized this until later, was they couldn't find no motive to hang on me. Of course the people in town, and Dr. McAuliffe too, I have no doubt, thought that if I had done it, I did it to get shot of him beating me. But all by itself, that didn't carry enough weight. Only Selina and Mr. Pease knew how much motive I'd really had. And no one, not even smart old Dr. McAuliffe, thought of questioning Mr. Pease. He didn't come forward on his own hook, either. If he had of, our little talk in the chatty buoy would have come out, and he'd most likely have been in trouble with the bank. I'd talked him into breaking the rules, after all. As for Selina, well, I think Selina tried me in her own court. Every now and then I'd see her eyes on me, dark as the ocean ahead of a squall line, and in my mind I'd hear her asking, "Did you do anything to him? Did you, Mama? Is it my fault?" Am I the one who has to pay? I think she did pay. That's the worst part. The little island girl who was never out of the state of Maine until she went to Boston for a swim meet when she was 18 has become a smart, successful career woman in New York City. There was an article about her in the New York Times 2 years ago. Did you know that? She writes for all those magazines and still finds time to write me once a week. But they feel like duty letters. Just like the phone calls twice a month feel like duty calls. I think the calls and the chatty little notes are the way she pays her heart to be quiet about how she don't ever come back here, about how she's cut her ties with me. Yes, I think she paid, all right. I think the one who was the most blameless of all paid the most, and that she's paying still. She's 44 years old and has never married. She's too thin, and I think she drinks. I've heard it in her voice more than once when she calls. I got an idea that might be one of the reasons she don't come home anymore. She doesn't want me to see her drinking like her father drank. Or maybe because she's afraid of what she might say if she had one too many while I was right handy. What she might ask. But never mind. It's all water over the dam now. I got away with it. That's the important thing. If there'd been insurance, or if Pease hadn't have kept his mouth shut, I'm not sure I would have. Of the two, a fat insurance policy probably would have been worse. The last thing in God's round world I needed was some smart insurance investigator hooking up with that smart little Scots doctor, who was already mad as hell at the idea of being beaten by an ignorant island woman. Nope, if there'd been two of them, I think they might have got me. So what happened? Why, what I imagine always happens in cases like that, when a murder's been done and not found out. Life went on, that's all. Nobody popped up with last-minute information, like in a movie. I didn't try to kill nobody else, and God didn't strike me dead with a lightning bolt. Maybe he felt hitting me with lightning over the likes of Joe St. George would have been a waste of electricity. I suppose that's blasphemy. But it also feels like nothing but the truth. Life just went on. I went back to Pinewood and to Vera. Selena took up her old friendships when she went back to school that fall, and sometimes I heard her laughing on the phone. When the news finally sunk in, little Pete took it hard. And so did Joe Jr. Joey took it harder than I'd expected, actually. He lost some weight and had some nightmares. But by the next summer, he seemed mostly all right again. The only thing that really changed during the rest of 1963 was that I had Seth Reed come over and put a cement cap on the old well. 6 months after he died, Joe's estate was settled in county probate. I wasn't even there. A week or so later, I got a paper telling me that everything was mine. I could sell it or swap it or drop it in the deep blue sea. When I'd got done going through what he'd left, I thought the last of those choices looked like the best one. One kind of surprising thing I discovered, though, if your husband dies sudden, it can come in handy if all his friends were idiots, like Joe's were. I sold the old shortwave radio he'd been tinkering on for 10 years to Norris Panett for $25. And the three junk trucks setting in the backyard to Tommy Anderson. That fool was more'n glad to have 'em, and I used the money to buy a 59 Chevy that had wheezy valves but ran good otherwise. I also had Joe's savings passbook made over to me and reopened the kids' college accounts. Oh, and one other thing. In January of 1964, I started going by my maiden name again. I didn't make no particular fanfare about it, but I was damned if I was going to drag St. George around behind me the rest of my life like a can tied to a dog's tail. I guess you could say I cut the string holding the can. But I didn't get rid of him as easy as I got rid of his name, I can tell you that. Not that I expected to. I'm 65, and I've known for at least 50 of those years that most of what being human's about is making choices and paying the bills when they come due. Some of the choices are pretty goddamn nasty, but but that don't give a person leave to just walk away from them, especially not if that person's got others dependent on it to do for them what they can't do for themselves. In a case like that, you just have to make the best choice you can and then pay the price. For me, the price was a lot of nights when I woke up in a cold sweat from bad dreams, and even more when I never got to sleep at all. That and the sound the rock made when it hit him in the face, busting his skull and his dentures. That sound, like a china plate on a brick hearth. I've heard it for 30 years. Sometimes it's what wakes me up, and sometimes it's what keeps me out of sleep. And sometimes it surprises me in broad daylight. I might be sweeping the porch at home, or polishing the silver at Vera's, or sitting down to my lunch with the TV turned to the Oprah show. And all at once I'll hear it. That sound. Or the thud when he hit bottom. Or his voice coming up out of the well. Dolores. I don't suppose those sounds I sometimes hear are so different from whatever it was that Vera really saw when she screamed about the wires in the corners or the dust bunnies under the bed. There were times, especially after she really began to fail, when I'd crawl in bed with her and hold her and think of the sound the rock made, and then close my eyes and see a china plate striking a brick hearth and shattering all to bits. When I saw that, I'd hug her like she was my sister, or like she was myself. We'd lie in that bed, each with her own fright, and finally we'd drowse off together, her with me to keep the dust bunnies away, and me with her to keep away the sound of the china plate. And sometimes before I went to sleep, I'd think, this is how you pay off being a bitch. And it ain't no use saying if you hadn't been a bitch, you wouldn't have had to pay. Because sometimes the world makes you be a bitch. When it's all doom and dark outside and only you inside to first make a light and then tend it, you have to be a bitch. But oh, the price. The terrible price. Andy, you suppose I could have one more tiny little nip from that bottle of yours? I'll never tell a soul. Thank you. And thank you, Nancy Bannister, for putting up with such a long-winded old broad as me. How are your fingers holding out? Are they? Good. Don't lose your courage now. I've gone at it widder shins, I know, but I guess I've finally gotten around to the part you really want to hear about just the same. That's good, because it's late and I'm tired. I've been working my whole life, but I can't remember ever being as tired as I am right now. I was out hanging laundry yesterday morning. It seems like 6 years ago, but it was only yesterday. And Vera was having one of her bright days. That's why it was all so unexpected, and partly why I got so flustered. When she had her bright days, she sometimes got bitchy, but that was the first and last time she got crazy. So I was down below in the side yard, and she was up above in her wheelchair, supervising the operations the way she liked to do. Every now and then she'd holler down, 6 pins, Dolores, 6 pins on every last one of those sheets. Don't you try to get away with just 4, because I'm watching. Yeah, I says, I know. And I'll bet you only wish it was 40 degrees colder and a 20-knot gale blowing. What? She caws down at me. What did you say, Dolores Claiborne? I said someone must be spreading manure in their garden, I says, because I smell a lot more bullshit around here than usual. Are you being smart, Dolores? She calls back in her cracked, wavery voice. She sounded about like she did on any day when a few more sunbeams than usual was finding their way into her attic. I knew she might get up to mischief later on, but I didn't much care. Right then I was just glad to hear her making as much sense as she was. To tell you the truth, it seemed like old times. She'd been numbering a pounded thumb for the last 3 or 4 months, and it was sort of nice to have her back. Or as much of the old Vera as was ever going to come back, if you see what I mean. No, Vera, I called up to her. If I'd been smart, I'd have gotten done working for you a long time ago. I expected her to yell something else down at me then, but she never. So I went on hanging up her sheets and her diapers and her washcloths and all the rest. Then with half the basket still to do, I stopped. I had a bad feeling. I can't say why or even where it started. All at once it was just there, a real bad feeling. And for just a moment the strangest thought came to me. That girl's in trouble. The one I saw on the day of the eclipse. The one who saw me. She's all grown up now, almost Selena's age, but she's in terrible trouble. I turned around and looked up, almost expecting to see the grown-up version of that little girl in her bright striped dress and pink lipstick, but I didn't see nobody, and that was wrong. It was wrong because Vera should have been there, just about hanging on to the roof to make sure I used the right number of clothespins. But she was gone. And I didn't understand how that could be, because I'd put her in her chair myself and then set the brake once I had it by the window the way she liked. Then I heard her scream, "Dolores!" Such a chill ran up my back when I heard that, Andy. It was like Joe had come back and was in the room with her. For a moment, I was just frozen to the spot. And she screamed again, and that second time I recognized it was her. "Dolores! It's the dust bunnies! They're everywhere! Oh, dear God! Oh, dear God! Dolores! Help! Help me!" I turned to run for the house, tripped over the damn laundry basket, and went sprawling over it into the sheets I just hung. I got tangled up in him somehow and had to fight my way out. For just a minute, it was like the sheets had grown hands and were trying to strangle me or just hold me back. And all the while that was going on, Vera kept screaming, and I thought of the dream I'd had that one time, the dream of the dust head with all the long, snaggly dust teeth. Only what I saw in my mind's eye was Joe's face on that head, and the eyes were all dark and blank, like someone had pushed two lumps of coal into a cloud of dust, and there they hung and floated. "Dolores, oh, please come quick. Oh, please come quick. The dust bunnies are everywhere." Then she just screamed. It was horrible. You'd never in your wildest dreams have thought a fat old bitch like Vera Donovan could scream that loud. It was like fire and flood and the end of the world all rolled up into one. I fought my way clear of the sheet somehow, and as I got up, I felt one of my slip straps pop, just like on the day of the eclipse, when Joe almost killed me before I managed to get shut of him. And you know that feeling you get when you feel like you've been someplace before, and know all the things people are going to say before they say them. That feeling came over me so strong, it was like there were ghosts all around me, tickling me with fingers I couldn't quite see. And you know something else? They felt like dusty ghosts. I ran in the kitchen door and pelted up the back stairs as fast as my legs would carry me, and all the time she was screaming, screaming, screaming. My slip started to slide down, and when I got to the back landing, I looked around. Sure, I was gonna see Joe stumbling up right behind me and snatching at the hem. Then I looked back the other way, and I seen Vera. She was three-quarters of the way down the hall toward the front staircase, waddling along with her back to me and screaming as she went. There was a big brown stain on the seat of her nightgown where she'd soiled herself. Not out of meanness or bitchiness that last time, but out of plain cold fear. Her wheelchair was stuck crosswise in her bedroom door. She must have released the brake when she saw whatever it was that had scared her so. Always before, when she was in one of her twilight times and got scared, the only thing she could do was sit or lay where she was and bawl for help. And there'll be plenty of people who'll tell you she couldn't move under her own power. But she did yesterday. I swear, she did. She released the brake on her chair, turned it, wheeled it across the room, then somehow got out of it when it got stuck in the doorway and went staggering off down the hall. I stood there, just frozen to the spot for the first second or two, watching her lurch along and wondering what she'd seen that was terrible enough to get her to do what she was doing, to walk after her days of walking should have been over. What that thing was that she could only think to call the dust bunnies. But I seen where she was headed, right for the front stairs. Vera, I yelled at her. Vera, you just stop this foolishness. You're going to fall. Stop. Then I ran just as fast as I could. That feeling that all this was happening for the second time rolled over me again. Only this time it felt like I was Joe, that I was the one trying to catch up and catch hold. I don't know if she didn't hear me, or if she did and thought in her poor, addled brain that I was in front of her instead of behind. All I know for sure is that she went on screaming, "Dolores, help! Help me, Dolores! The dust bunnies!" and lurched on a little faster. She'd just about used the hallway up. I raced past the door to her room and clipped my ankle a goddamn good one on one of the wheelchair's footrests. Here you can see the bruise. I ran as fast as I could, shouting, "Stop! Vera, stop!" until my throat was raw. She crossed the landing and stuck one foot out into space. I couldn't have saved her then, no matter what. All I could have done was pull myself over with her. But in a situation like that, you don't have time to think or count the cost. I jumped for her, just as that foot of hers come down on thin air, and she started to tilt forward. I had one last little glimpse of her face. I don't think she knew she was going over. There wasn't nothing there but bug-eyed panic. I'd seen the look before, although never that deep, and I can tell you it didn't have nothing to do with fear of falling. She was thinking about what was behind her, not what was ahead. I snatched at the air and didn't get nothing but the littlest fold of her nightie between the second and third fingers of my left hand. It slipped through them like a whisper. "Dolore!" she screamed, and then there was a solid, meaty thud. It turns my blood cold to remember that sound. It was just like the one Joe made when he hit the bottom of the well. I seen her do a cartwheel and then heard something snap. The sound was as clear and harsh as a stick of kindling when you break it over your knee. I saw blood squirt out of the side of her head, and that was all I wanted to see. I turned away so fast my feet tangled in each other and I went to my knees. I was staring back down the hallway toward her room, and what I saw made me scream. It was Joe. For a few seconds, I saw him as clear as I see you now, Andy. I saw his dusty, grinning face peeking out at me from under her wheelchair, looking through the wire spokes of the wheel that had got caught in the door. Then it was gone, and I heard her moaning and crying. I couldn't believe she'd lived through that fall. Can't believe it still. Joe hadn't been killed outright either, of course, but he'd been a man in the prime of life, and she was a flabby old woman who'd had half a dozen small strokes and at least three big ones. Also, there wasn't no mud and squelch to cushion her landing like there'd been to cushion his. I didn't want to go down to her. Didn't want to see where she was broken and bleeding. But there weren't no question, of course. I was the only one there, and that meant I was elected. When I got up, I had to haul on the newel post at the top of the banister to do it. My knees were so watery feeling. I stepped one foot on the hem of my own slip. The other strap popped, and I raised up my dress a little so I could pull it off. And that was just like before, too. I remember looking down at my legs to see if they were scratched and bleeding from the thorns in the blackberry tangle. But, of course, there wasn't nothing like that. I felt feverish. If you've ever been really sick and your temperature's gone way, way up, you know what I mean. You don't feel out of the world exactly, but you sure as hell don't feel in it either. It's like everything was turned to glass, and there isn't anything you can get a solid grip on anymore. Everything's slippery. That's how I felt as I stood there on the landing. holding the top of the banister in a death grip and looking at where she'd finished up. She was laying a little over halfway down the staircase, with both legs twisted so far under her you couldn't hardly see them. Blood was running down one side of her poor old face. When I stumbled down to where she lay, still clinging on to the banister for dear life as I went, one of her eyes rolled up in its socket to mark me. It was the look of an animal caught in a trap. "Dolores," she whispered, "that son of a bitch has been after me all these years." "Shh," I said, "don't try to talk." "Yes, he has," she said, as if I'd contradicted her. "Oh, the bastard, the randy bastard." "I'm going downstairs," I says. "I got to call the doctor." "No," she says back. She reached up with one hand and took hold of my wrist. "No doctor, no hospital. The dust bunnies, even there, everywhere." "You'll be all right, Vera," I says, pulling my hand free. "As long as you lie still and don't move, you'll be fine." "Dolores Claiborne says I'm going to be fine," she says. And it was that dry, fierce voice she used to use before she had her strokes and got all muddled in her head. What a relief it is to have a professional opinion. Hearing that voice, after all the years it had been gone, was like being slapped. It shocked me right out of my panic, and I really looked into her face for the first time, the way you look at a person who knows exactly what they're saying and means every word. "I'm as good as dead," she says, "and you know it as well as I do. My back's broken, I think." "You don't know that, Vera," I says, but I wasn't wild to get to the telephone like I had been. I think I knew what was coming. And if she asked what I thought she was going to ask, I didn't see how I could refuse her. I had owed her a debt ever since that rainy fall day in 1962 when I sat on her bed and bawled my eyes out with my apron up over my face. And the Claibornes have always cleared their debts. When she spoke to me again, she was as clear and as lucid as she'd been 30 years ago, back when Joe was alive and the kids were still at home. "I know there's only one thing left worth deciding," she says, "and that's whether I'm going to die in my time or in some hospital's. Their time would be too long. My time is now, Dolores. I'm tired of seeing my husband's face in the corners when I'm weak and confused. I'm tired of seeing them winch that Corvette out of the quarry in the moonlight. How the water ran out of the open window on the passenger side." "Vera, I don't know what you're talking about," I says. She lifted her hand and waved it at me in her old impatient way for a second or two. Then it flopped back onto the stairs beside her. "I'm tired of pissing down my legs and forgetting who came to see me half an hour after they are gone. I want to be done. Will you help me?" I knelt beside her, picked up the hand that had fallen on the stairs, and held it against my bosom. I thought about the sound the rock made when it hit Joe in the face, that sound like a china plate breaking all to splinters on a brick hearth. I wondered if I could hear that sound again without losing my mind. And I knew it would sound the same, because she'd sounded like him when she was calling my name. She'd sounded like him when she fell and landed on the stairs, breaking herself all to pieces, just like she'd always been afraid the maids would break the delicate glassware she kept in the parlor. And my slip was laying on the upstairs landing in a little ball of white nylon with both straps busted. And that was just like before, too. If I did her, it'd sound the same as it had when I did him. And I knew it. Hey, I knew it. As well as I know that East Lane ends in those rickety old stairs going down the side of East Head. I held her hand and thought about how the world is, how sometimes bad men have accidents and good women turn into bitches, I looked at the awful, helpless way her eyes rolled so she could look up into my face, and I marked how the blood from the cut in her scalp ran down the deep wrinkles in her cheek, the way spring rain runs in plow furrows going downhill. I says, "If it's what you want, Vera, I'll help you."